Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, a member of the club's Board of Governors and your chair for today's session. We also welcome our listeners on the radio. And now it is my pleasure to welcome and introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. David Kaye. What a privilege it is to have you with us today, David. David Kaye is a seasoned professional. He has spent years working with international organizations, including the International Atomic Energy Agency. He served as the IAEA and UNSCOM Chief Nuclear Weapons Inspector, leading numerous inspections into Iraq following the end of the Gulf War. And indeed, in 1991, he spent 4 days as a Saddam Hussein hostage in a parking lot in Baghdad. As most of you know, David Kaye led the Iraq Survey Group that took over responsibility for the hunt for weapons of mass destruction in June 2003, 1 year ago. After 6 months of work in January 2004, Dr. Kaye reported before Congress, and to the astonishment of many, that, quote, "We were almost all wrong, and I include myself here," unquote, concluding that there were no stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq at the time we went to war there last year. Dr. Kaye went on to note in this testimony, quote, "We're also in a period in which we've had intelligence surprises in the proliferation area that go the other way," unquote, such as Iran and Libya. His overall point was that the problem of global proliferation of weapons of mass destruction technology is an urgent policy issue, and that we need to ensure that the intelligence community is able to do a better job in the future. I hope that this forward-looking agenda is something we can concentrate on in our discussion with you today, David, as accurate, timely, and actionable intelligence regarding weapons of mass destruction programs is vital to American security. Indeed, I understand that you're trying to complete a book on this very topic, on the kind of intelligence we need to face the new security threats that we face. We look forward to hearing your perspective, and your presence today could not be more timely. Given the sellout crowd, you can see how much interest there is in our community, given the momentous news of the early handover of authority in Baghdad this morning to the Iraqis. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. I'm very happy to be here. The problem when someone from Washington says that, you have to realize you're always happy wherever you are when you're from Washington. I used to come back to Baghdad after congressional hearings and say how glad I was to be in Baghdad. At least there, they were generally shooting at you from the front, and you had rules of engagement which allowed you to return the fire. That's seldom true, never in my case, before congressional committees. I'm not going to talk about Iraq today, although I'm sure there will be a number of questions, or at least not directly about Iraq. What I'd like to talk about is something that I actually think is more important than Iraq. Iraq illustrates some of the points, but it's something I'm working on, and so it's a work in progress, and so I'd like to share where I'm going with regard to this. We're in a remarkable time in this country. We have actually only had three periods in U.S. history since 1776 when we've had to re-examine and readjust almost totally our national security policy. From 1776 to 1914, our basic national security strategy was to keep other powers out of the Western Hemisphere. Everyone in school, Monroe Doctrine, but it was more complex than the Monroe Doctrine. Sometimes it involved military action, sometimes political action, sometimes cash, as in the Louisiana Purchase or the Seward Purchase of Alaska. But that was the dominant security motif from 1776 to 1914. After 1914, and literally up until 2001, and these end dates are always soft as they are in history when you're trying to make general cuts like that, our national security policy recognized the importance initially of the balance of power in Europe and the importance of ensuring that a state hostile to the United States did not become the dominant political power. After the Second World War, the world became more globally, and it was not just Europe, although it was largely a European-centric policy, and in the contest with the Soviet Union, generally went globally. We're now without a good name, struggling with a national security challenge which says the enemy may be within us. We no longer have the luxury of distance, of continental detachment, and we really don't know exactly who we're struggling against. Now, too often, I think, in the U.S., this discussion has taken the form of worries about terrorism, worries about weapons of mass destruction, both of which are important, but are actually tactics for the fundamental problem. And I think we need to identify, before we start thinking of a war on, need to identify what are the root causes that are changing our national security posture today and changing the threats that we face in the world. I think there are several of these, and in the limited time we have available, I really only want to concentrate on 2.5. The first is what I call vulnerable societies or failed states. Really depends on whether I'm trying to be more or less politically correct. There are, if you take UN data, data from any number of private NGOs that are working on that, 50 to 70 states around the world that you can say today are at least vulnerable or actually have failed. And these cut across the world. There are states like North Korea, certainly a state unable to perform economically, socially, that is, although it has immense weapons, is actually a failed societal organization. Zimbabwe in Africa, and Pakistan I would put in that category. Iraq was, I think, at the time of Operation Iraqi Freedom, a failed state. We didn't recognize that, and in fact that changed. Military action would have probably taken a different form if we had fully realized that. Now, why these states fail, it's important to understand. Now, some of these reasons I think we understand. Others we probably are still grappling with, at least I'm grappling with understanding. Clearly part of the issue is demography. In Western Europe, and this is pretty much true in the United States as well, roughly 17% of the population is under 15. In Iraq today, 62% of the population is under the age of 15. In the Middle East as a whole, it's about 50%. Under 15. Under 24, I think the figure rises to about 62% for the Middle East. Take a country like Yemen, which is a factoid of note. Yemen is a small state with virtually no economy, unless drug smuggling happens to be an economy, as it is for some states. Will have, at mid-century, the second largest population in the Middle East, about 105 million people, without ever having had a public education system, a public health system, any form of a recognized economy. Unemployment is the recognized economy. And struggling with over half of its population being under the age of 15 throughout that period of time. Is there any surprise that as you go through Al-Qaeda ranks and other ranks today of terrorist groups, you find a large proportion of Yemenis? Sudan's another example of this, a huge democratic pressure. In fact, Sudan will be the third largest country in the Middle East at mid-century. So there clearly are demographic issues out there that stress societies, but there are other issues as well. Some of them are economic. Most of the 50 to 70 states are states that have a single dependable source of income, either a single crop or a single raw material natural resource like oil. It's very hard to manage an economy like that, and is threatened with huge cycles of income disparity that are created by the very nature of a single crop or a single income society. And some of these often go in ways that we don't recognize because of our lag in our memory. Best example of this is Saudi Arabia. Many of us today, if someone says Saudi Arabia to you, the image that crops up into your mind is tremendous wealth, exaggerated wealth of building mansions, importing everything, flying around the world, the Arabian Nights sort of image. How many people realize that per capita income in Saudi Arabia today is one half of what it was in 1972? So you're looking at a population that as they sons and daughters look, and then I should be not politically correct, let me say in Saudi Arabia, it's sons, look at their fathers, their uncles, their elder brothers. They had a life that they know they will not have. The social pressures that that cause has tremendous economic flux, rivers in society. Nigeria is much the same way. Oil brought tremendous wealth, but oil comes and goes price-wise. Unfortunately, this year it's going the wrong way for us. It's very good for countries like Nigeria. But the social pressures are tremendous in there. There are other things that take place in many of these failed states. A failure of social integration as they confront the external world. And I think I'm particularly unhappy with much of the analysis today, which would drive us to a war of civilizations. It's Islam against us. Islam, we're into a hopeless war. The only alternative is with Islam. The real war with Islam is internal to these countries. As some countries where Islam is the dominant religion make the transition to dealing with a modern society, a modern economy, and a modern world, and others, quite frankly, don't make the transition, and they're struggled into an internal civil war, which takes the form, very often because of government policy, of an external civil war against others. But the social integration or the failure to integrate across religious, ethnic lines, and across those lines and the modern world is a source of tremendous stress among these states. It is a common theme. Another common theme is past conflict. In fact, the easiest predictor of which states are going to be failed states are those states that have had coups, civil wars, revolutions in the past. I mean, a poster child for that has to be in our own hemisphere. It's Haiti. I mean, Haiti has been a failed state forever. In fact, one has to think when it was not a failed state. And we, as we look around today, I'm convinced that we are facing a growing tide of those states whose failure, and this is the position we too easily get involved in tactics because we don't ask the question of when fundamental changes like that are taking place in the world, what difference does it make to us as Americans? Because unless they're threatening us, we can ignore it. I think that is a great weakness in our national security policy and one that we must address. Look, at one level, most of these states will, at one time or the other, become humanitarian disasters. And as you look at the Sudan today, which most of us don't look at, it's not on the nightly news, it's not something that concerns us, it is a tragedy of immense dimensions, what has been going on in the Sudan, and yet we choose to ignore it. Sometimes these will cause migratory fluxes. I mean, if you live in Florida, Haiti is important to you because it can be a source of migration as Haiti fails once again. Much of Western Europe has that same concern about failures in Asia, in the Middle East, and in North Africa. It also should be a concern to us because, in fact, in the world that we live in, where communications is easy, where people move, those become the seabeds of future armed conflict that can indeed threaten us. And I just remind you, as we take great pride, particularly in a city like San Francisco, even in Washington, where I must say it's improved the quality of restaurants immensely, by ethnic food. I mean, you can track where which state is failing by which new ethnic restaurant is in vogue. And that's the good side. But the bad side to that is to recognize our neighbors, as you look around us, many of them come from those states, and they're good people seeking a better life for themselves and for their children. But in fact, if some of their group, because of what is going at home, pick up arms, decide to challenge the United States, it is going to come home to us yet again. And as a threat to democracy, a society that is based on pluralism, freedom of association, diversity, freedom of choice, we've got to worry about that. If Pogo is right, I've met the enemy and he is us. in terms of how we adapt to that national security threat. So it is one that is vital to us. It's vital for other reasons as well. Some of these countries sit astride natural resources that are immensely important to the United States. And that's particularly true of oil, but it's true of other commodities as well. Let me hit two other sources of international conflict that I think we're going to face in the future in a way that we haven't faced in the past and barely recognize. First is conflict over natural resources. Here, I think the poster child for this in the future are going to be oil and water. We are about to see in regions of the world, you've already got conflict, but actually moving to major conflict as water becomes the scarce resource that decides how countries are going to live. The Middle East is a classic example of that, but there are examples in Africa and in Asia of that as well. Oil, barely, and it is barely now, you're getting public recognition of the implications of the Chinese getting wealthy. If the Chinese become like Californians, and they become like Texans, and God help them if they get Hummers, you're talking about a demand on global petroleum that is going to lead to competition that becomes a political strain. And you've got to recognize we're going to have to deal with that. There is a third area, which I think most often will show up because it pushes states into the failed category. But in some ways, it also is likely to be a direct conflict. And I think there are examples of that. At least I'm trying to tease out some examples as I do some writing on it. And that are these transnational issues. Some of them are health-related crises, AIDS, SARS, emerging diseases. You already saw last year with the SARS crisis, the world picking on China, the world picking on Hong Kong. You're not doing enough about it. We're going to close tourism. We're going to shut down flights to it and the reaction to that. There is a tremendous danger of those sort of issues having both an impact that pushes a state over into a failed category as well as becoming a conflict itself. The one that hasn't hit us, except if you look at very few examples, mad cow disease, foot and mouth disease being the two best, but I think in the next decade is likely to be more emergent, and that's agricultural diseases. We have created a worldwide system of agriculture which is extraordinarily vulnerable to new emerging diseases that can ripple through the system with tremendous speed. If that starts, the finger pointing of you allowed it to start there, you Canadians, I mean, we blame the Canadians. California's great, you never have bad weather, but those of us who live in the rest of the country, it's the Canadians that send the cold fronts against us. And I sometimes wonder why we haven't had a war on Canadians. We've got a war on poverty, war on terrorism, war on cancer. We might as well go about something that makes my life at least 4 months of the year unpleasant and deal with the Canadians. But you know, if the Canadians, the Brits, you name it, don't deal with mad cow disease, don't deal with foot and mouth disease, don't deal with the latest crop disease to crop up and run through the winter wheat crop, those are things that will cause conflict. And we are more vulnerable now to that than we ever have been because of the nature of the global economy. And let me add and end in that category on one that most politicians, particularly in Washington, but occasionally I hear even in California, want to look the other way on, and that's climate change. Global climate change has the potential of both pushing countries that are marginally viable into the category of failed states, as well as becoming who's responsible for this and becoming sources of political conflict among states themselves. And certainly as Americans, as consumers, largest consumers of resources in the world, we ought to recognize our own vulnerability to be picked on that for, I think, actually good reason. Now, these are the types of sources of conflict. Let me look briefly at the tactics. And it's the tactics that make the sources. In an isolated world where no one could reach out and hurt us, who would care? You know, as it used to be said, at least when I started life in Washington, a good humanitarian disaster would get you from the U.S. Congress maybe $5 million. Inflation has taken that up to a larger sum. But there is a limit to it. But what has changed are principally two things. One is access to weapons of mass destruction, or weapons of great destructive power, as I prefer, it's mass casualties as opposed to mass destruction, as well as the openness of the United States to the world. And let me start by giving you an example of why weapons of mass destruction, mass casualties, are more available today than ever before, and give it to you as a personal biography of a very interesting individual, the individual who's responsible individually for more proliferation of nuclear technology and missile technology than any other single individual around the world. Born in Bhopal, India in 1935, when India was a British colony, immigrated with his parents in the early 50s to Pakistan after Pakistan and India was split. In the early 60s, went to Western Europe on a government fellowship to get an engineering degree, did very well, went to work for a consortium of three states that produced enriched uranium in Europe, and was one of those fantastic workers that you'd love to have working for you unless you're the treasurer of a company. That is, this is an individual who worked late every night, worked late on weekends, took work home. I mean, the ideal person to have on your team. Then, after the Indian nuclear explosion, he went back to Pakistan, and within 2 years had a Pakistan uranium enrichment program, and by 1989-1990 was offering to states around the world to sell them a complete package that include not only a uranium enrichment program, but also a weapon design, as well as missile technology. This is A.Q. Khan, who you may have heard of. Now, it's a fantastic personal story, but it also is a story that emphasizes our vulnerability. We're an open world. People can come to our educational institutions. We try not to discriminate, or at least we try not to depending on how you view certain government policies in certain states, to be open to students, to allow them to participate. We generally try to facilitate their staying on to work in our enterprises. We value their work, we profit by it. Our economy would be extraordinarily different for the worst if we didn't do that, and yet that capability can transfer in a miraculous period. Pakistan, a failed state, having nuclear technology capability, so that literally, and if you look at A.Q. Khan's efforts, this is a book I should be writing. A.Q. Khan, really, his model seems to have been, before it existed, Amazon.com. Khan offered, take what he did with Libya. You know, Libya, you want to have a nuclear weapon, you need to enrich uranium, I'll sell you the manufacturing capability to do that, the parts. Oh, you can't manufacture it here? Not a problem. We'll set up a subsidiary plant in Malaysia. They'll produce the parts and we'll have them delivered here. Oh, you have a problem? FedEx doesn't deliver? That's all right. I have friends in the Pakistani Air Force that will fly it out to Dubai and we'll move it into the shipping lanes and move it to you. I mean, it in many ways is the model of a modern entrepreneur, except for $100 million a pop. He was offering some of the most destructive technology that man has yet produced. The second reason is a reason that we're all getting older, and most of this destructive technology that we still think about as being modern is actually 60, 70, 80, 90 years old. Most of the chemical weapon technology dates to World War I and World War II. And quite frankly, if you want to make nerve gas, there are internet sites that tell you how to do it, and the ingredients are in any agricultural co-op to do a pretty good nerve gas knockoff on it. And that too is sitting on the internet. Most of the science, anthrax, for example, that almost closed down Washington, I know some of you would think that wouldn't be a bad thing, but it came very close with a very small amount of anthrax to closing down the postal system and essentially closing down governmental Washington. Anthrax and that technology is now well over 60 years old, and most of it is commercially available if you want to do it and you want to learn how to do it. So the technology has just become available. The internet as a means of propagating that technology has become more powerful. So you can do it. I will give you one Iraq story. My favorite group of people who were willing to help Iraq during the late 1990s extend their missile program were a group that came from Russia. Spent 6 months in Russia, six months in Baghdad, probably wishing they were in Russia, but 6 months in Baghdad, working on the Iraqi missile program, went back home, continued to work on the program, sending the Iraqis, using the internet, updates on what they ought to do, reviewing their plans, helping them if they needed parts, not a problem. We can get it shipped to you, and here's how you got to go. It's just become an easier world to communicate with. And then the final issue is the issue of what's happened to us. In a way that would absolutely amaze my parents, I think, but certainly my grandparents or great-grandparents, we've become a society that depends and is open to the world. It's living up, really, to the fundamental values at the founding of this country. Diversity, freedom of association, independence, willingness, keep the government out and let people get on with their act. If you look at how Ford Motor Company, how Macy's, how any large enterprise deals today with just-in-time delivery, outsourcing things to the world, integrating them here, moving them around, it really means we are more vulnerable in a fundamental way than we've ever been before. You almost wish for the world in which you had to worry about missiles flying over our horizon or a fleet of aircraft, or to go not that far back in our history, ships showing up off the shores of California, a fleet, that fleet is here. It lives in San Jose. It lives in Oakland, in the Berkeley Hills. We are there and we're open to it. So there is no longer a boundary that separates us from the rest of the world. Now, let me hit just briefly the issue of terrorism, because I think we have misunderstood, and I particularly don't like the idea. It's one of these militarized terms, which I guess as a Texan I take responsibility for, since really Lyndon Johnson first introduced it into large use in War on Poverty. We have to have a war on everything, and so we have a war on terrorism. Without understanding the roots of terrorism and why terrorism has emerged, I think there's some basic things, and we don't have a lot of time, and I'll quickly conclude on this. First of all, the change. Terrorism has been around for a long time, but terrorism was a means to an objective. Take my classic terrorist group, the IRA. Get the British out of Northern Ireland. You don't want to destroy Britain, and you certainly don't want to destroy Northern Ireland. You want to change the political class. And in general, that's what terrorism has been about, changing the rulers and putting our guys in power. That's not what terrorism is about now. Terrorism is about what I've called in a piece the culture of death. I die, therefore I am. The willingness for ultimate sacrifice in order to obtain some lofty goal, which is in the hereafter. We are being urged, so let me, we're not, I read the wrong number, that's one problem. And I won't tell you my economist joke, which proves that I have a problem with that, but anyway. Look, these terrorists are different in another way. Most of our image of terrorists is as of young, hopeless men. It's interesting if you read the biography of the 9/11 terrorists, or the biography of those who carried out the Madrid bombing. These are not young, hopeless people. They're mostly middle-aged. They often came to where they are in life with fellowships. They studied at very good universities. Ada is a classic example of it. Could have been an urban planner in Germany. The mastermind of the Madrid bombing also came from North Africa. Studied architecture, urban planning. There may be something about urban planning, I don't know, as a key insight here. But these are people who actually had many of the same possibilities. They also were not single. They had families. They had wives. They had children. And yet they were willing to sacrifice themselves for a different goal. They also have capabilities in a way that terrorists have never wanted and have never been able to have, although they may have wanted them in the past. So there are some fundamental changes going on in the world of terrorism that we ought to think about. And mostly, let me tell you, with regard to targets and objects, the things you ought to think about is what you think are their targets probably are not. We should realize that the military is not the targets of terrorism. I mean, we like to think of a world that is symmetrical. You go up against our best, and we'll beat you. The terrorist is, because of what they're trying to accomplish, are seeking symbolic targets, large numbers of casualties. I talked recently to several real estate groups, and when I reel off the symbolic targets, and you think most of what we think about, if I name a city, what you think about it, and very often what comes up first is a real estate image, an image of a building, or in Minneapolis, an image of a shopping center, the Mall of America. These are things are vulnerable targets to terrorists, and the terrorists, in fact, are talking about and are seeking larger capabilities to. But let me go back to what I started on. These are tactics, and you've got to address root causes. There's simply not enough money in the American economy if all you can do is defend and improve your defenses. Because you have to win every day against terrorists, and you don't know when they're attacking. While defense is important, we really have to learn a lesson to think about what are in, what people who, in fact, want to do harm to us are about, why they've reached that position in life, and how we can change it. And this gets me to the last thing I really will, although it's what I'm really spending most of my time on now, hurry through, and that's the intelligence capabilities that we have or we need. We have an intelligence capability that was ideally designed and actually worked fairly well against the Soviet Union, a large continental target, 12, 13 time zones. I can never remember where it was, 12 or 13. I've always suspected the Russian, how can you have 13 time zones? This was exaggeration. But a huge continent, and it was opposing us militarily. So in fact, it needed to build and move large amounts of anything. It had to communicate across huge distances. So the opportunity of learning what they were saying, what they were thinking about, were just huge. It was a denied territory. It was hard to get to, but it was an immense target. You think about what you're going up against today. You're going up against denied networks, denied minds, small groups, where capabilities are not the thing that are at issue. It's their intention, their plans. What are they going to do tomorrow? What are they going to do next week? And for that sort of service, we have designed during the Cold War 14 named intelligence agencies in the U.S. 90% of the money for them is in the Department of Defense budget, and none of them do human penetration. We're out of that game. We decided to do technology because Americans do technology better than anyone in the world. And when you're going against the Soviets, technology was a great answer. But we now face a situation where the intelligence apparatus that helped us win the Cold War, and it wasn't all that good at times, but that's for another talk, is in fact completely inadequate for what we've done here. So the real challenge today is redesigning that intelligence capability in order to have a national security strategy that is adequate for dealing with the threats we face. And let me just conclude by saying, anyone who believes that the Department of Defense is the appropriate mechanism to deal with failed states has neither seen the Department of Defense or a failed state. We have got to pay attention. And here again, we have tremendous comparative advantages, so this should not be a real brain twister for the United States. Take almost any country in the world that has an education system that is practically non-existent or rudimentary. Now, unless you have the wealth of Abu Dhabi, going out and building a Cal Berkeley is nonsense. But there is an American model that works very well that we don't talk about, the community college system. The community college system in the United States is a tremendous integrator of people from various economic and national stratas. I mean, I live in Washington, which is the forefront of a lot of immigrants. I cannot tell you how many people we end up meeting who are temporarily plumbers, construction operators, who actually are not uneducated. They happen to be uncredentialed for American society. That is, they may be a doctor, they may be a plumber, they may be something else in El Salvador or someplace around the world. They're working on menial jobs while going to community colleges at night to get those credentials to integrate it. The same thing is true of poverty, of social integration. We have so much to bring to dealing with that, and it is in the national security basket if we stop and think about it. We cannot do it if we only think about what is the next war we're going to wage, whether it be a war on terrorism, a war on Islam, a war, et cetera, and you name your topic. We need to design an intelligence capability that helps us focus on where the problems are, and we need to think about a national security strategy that brings the full tools of America and our values and our capabilities to bear to change the world rather than simply worry about defending it after the attack has occurred. And on that note, Michael, I will stop. As you know, as an academic, I could go on.